You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 31st of May 2017 on Monocle 24. Live from London on Monocle 24, this is Midori House. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show, Kabul suffers one of its worst bomb attacks in years. At least 80 people are dead, with hundreds more wounded. Also ahead,
there have been an abundance of reports regarding surveillance and other type of activities that occurred during the 2016 election.
And that leads us to believe that the president's only evidence is these reports.
No. That leads you to believe that. I'm saying to you, right.
Donald Trump's staff must be getting used to chaos and contradictions. But amid yet another rumored reshuffle, will the president have trouble attracting fresh recruits? Plus, they said it was impossible, but could the UK be headed for a tight election? And we'll also find out why this week's number one single could be bad news for the future of British politics. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. Well, welcome to the show. And my guests today are Robert Fox, who's the defence editor for the London Evening Standard, and Isabel Hilton, who's the editor of China Dialogue, and both very regular voices, I'm glad to say, here on the show. And welcome to them. Now, nearly 2 hours after a massive explosion near Kabul's Zambak Square earlier today, plumes of smoke could still be seen rising high above the scene. At least 80 people are believed to have been killed, with hundreds more wounded. The blast occurred during the morning rush hour and ignited panic throughout much of the city, shattering windows as far as a mile away. Robert, it doesn't just shake the city, it shakes the whole country, this, isn't it? It's a huge attack, one of the biggest for years, right in the heart of Kabul. What does it mean for what we're seeing in Afghanistan?
Yes, certainly biggest for a very, very long time. It seemed to be very close to the German embassy. I talking to a senior British security advisor just an hour or so ago, experienced in Kabul. He said he didn't think it was necessarily aimed at the German embassy. They're very anxious to find out who really was behind this, whether it was IS, which has been resurgent in Afghanistan, or whether it was the Haqqani network or syndicate of the Taliban. Certainly, they're making colossal inroads. This was, and it's no cliche to say, it was quite indiscriminate. It's injured over 400 by the sound of it. Almost all Afghans. A few security guards. BBC lost a security guard killed. People injured. It is a real shaker. And it's very, very difficult for Trump now, when he is being asked by the American general in charge of the international force, Jim Nicholson, to send 3,000 or 5,000 troops. One wonders what even difference that would make now.
And just tell me, what was interesting, Robert, the Taliban, the main part of the Taliban, have said that it wasn't them and they regretted this loss of life. Is that to be believed, or do you feel that that's just different factions within Taliban speaking or not speaking?
Well, there is a kind of credibility to that, because I don't think we're quite assurer. Because they are very sensitive to the charges that they're killing so many Afghans. So many Afghans are dying. It's not making the international news as much as it should do. But the overrunning of large parts of Helmand, they're getting into the cities now. There's been a lot of activity in Kunduz, whether up on the borders. It is not in one particular area, although there are different constituents doing different things in different areas. And there is no doubt that there has been a lot of IS and indeed Al-Qaeda activity around the periphery. You have to look at it as center and periphery, and particularly to the east. This is where new groups have been coalescing, and they've got very, very good supply routes from the north, not necessarily from the south and the east, not necessarily from Pakistan, not necessarily coming in through the Khyber Pass and the access routes that way.
Interesting, Isabel, we've seen in recent months, we've talked about here on the show that, in fact, in Pakistan, things have got a little bit calmer. There seems to be a kind of crackdown on IS there in certain ways. It's certainly bring a bit more of a rigour to policing there. Maybe that has pushed some people back over the border into Afghanistan. But what do you think are the consequences of this for, the region?
Well, I think what we're seeing in the region is one of those rather important shifts with the retreat of US power, if you like. Just this month, there was a meeting in Pakistan of China, Afghanistan and Pakistan talking about investment and development in Afghanistan. And you have, you know, with the rise of China and with China's One Belt, One Road initiative with CPAC, China is now having to be much more proactive in regional security. This is new. China has not done this before, but it's going to have to do it if it's going to have fixed assets, you know, in very, very dodgy territory. And, you know, as, you know, America first means America pretty much absent in the long run. And we've seen it already remarkably quickly. You've seen a decline of American influence and power. And that means a fairly radical realignment of the already very complicated situation around Afghanistan. So you have Pakistan cleaving to China in order to restrict Indian influence in Afghanistan, which is its primary concern. You have India wondering if the United States is going to be, you know, a supportive ally to India in terms of the region. It's pretty complicated, and I think we'll see new actors emerging. It'll be interesting to see if China's pressure on Pakistan succeeds in persuading Pakistan to discontinue its support for terrorist groups, which, you know, Pakistan has used for many years as an instrument of foreign policy and an instrument of its defense policy. Because, of course, China itself is very vulnerable because of Xinjiang, because of its treatment of the Muslim majority in Xinjiang, which has been rougher and rougher, and seems to have produced pretty much what they said they didn't want, which is a determined and you know, small but armed opposition in Xinjiang. So we're looking at a very interesting shifting pattern right now, which I think is a historic shift.
Well, but you said it's a difficult moment for the US, but do you think that attacks like this could have, you know, the opposite consequences for whoever's responsible and they want, rather than, you know, changing the landscape in Afghanistan? It could draw America back in. It could make America say, you know, America's, you know, Donald Trump has said, we will, you know, crush terrorism. We will go against the people who, you know, are the people who caused, you know, September 11 all that time ago. Do you think it could draw America back into the fold?
Yes, but not in the old form, I agree. And they will be much seized of this, of what the real problem is, because they have two people very experienced in Afghanistan in different guises, both Jim Mattis, former four-star general, and H.R. McMaster, whom I saw in Afghanistan in his last command there. And so they will know the problem, but they will see the friability of Afghanistan as such a huge problem. And then this brings another complication, because I don't want to do a sort of catalogue aria like Don Giovanni, but the fact is that Iran and Russia must be terribly worried by this, because what is happening on the steppe is worrying anyway with for Russia, for not dissimilar reasons to China, because it is Islamic non-Russian, very Asiatic militancy, which really does worry them. That's why they're getting so much involved there. And for Iran, we forget over and over again, they have had to deal with a very, very serious and continuing refugee problem, which they see as threatening to them, because actually they've always been very careful with the Taliban. Although Taliban leaders have tried to flee to Tehran, they've kept them there more or less as sort of honored guests slash prisoners. They don't want this violence on their border, because actually there is enough violence anyway with nationalist movements like the Baloch. So I think it is very useful. I'm again talking to a very senior national security advisor of the UK, and he was saying he is very worried that the Europeans, in which he still very much included the UK, and to a certain extent the Americans, are not seeing the security crisis from Moscow, with Moscow at the centre of it. And if you start looking at that, and you look at the unstable crescent leading further south into what they now call the chaos zone, it is very, very problematic indeed. Because to go back to what we're saying, who was behind this? Was it the IS elements? Was it the Haqqani network? And I absolutely almost rule out the old Mullah Omar elements of the Quetta Shura. But none of the above, to my estimation, shows any capability of being able to run a government. They're not going to make things more stable in Afghanistan. And this incredible multidimensional communal war is very worrying for all the people that we've described.
Just before we move on, Isabel, you described something very interesting about China. Now, normally when we think about Chinese connections with neighbouring countries, it's on the basis of we won't meddle in your foreign policy or in your relations with neighbours. You know, we just want to do we're just here to do business, whether that's true or not. But now here's an instance where you're implying that actually it may be a different approach they would take, that they would say, okay, we need to do something to shore up Afghanistan because this is going to have consequences for us.
Well, I think the two are related. I mean, you shouldn't forget that in a fit of exuberance, China bought the world's third largest copper deposit, which is in Afghanistan, and something that it has never been able to develop.
Absolutely.
And for all these years, China has, in its limited operations in Afghanistan, but, you know, it does have them, has depended on the US security network. I mean, it has ridden under US security provision. If that is going to diminish, then China is simply going to have to step up. And we've seen signs of this, you know, quite small in their beginnings over 2 or 3 years. Zhou Yongkang, when he was still security czar, visited Afghanistan. This is not a man, you know, the standing committee member of the Politburo, subsequently taken down for corruption. But he was, you know, he was central to the whole Chinese security apparatus. If he's in Afghanistan, he's there for a reason. And I think that we're seeing this develop.
Well, we're going to move on now to Washington, where since Donald Trump took a seat in the Oval Office, scenes of the president venting his frustrations in public settings have become unusually common. Well, according to advisers cited by the New York Times, the president has been openly raising the prospect of giving his staff a shake-up. But as the Russia inquiry intensifies, some posts that might once have been seen as plum roles are now attracting fewer expressions of interest. Isabel, when you look at what's happening, it's amazing that we're only kind of 6 months into this administration, a four-year run, and it does feel like endless chaos. And with, you know, the Russia inquiries, you know, looming, it's going to be a hot seat for anybody who decides to come into the inner circle, isn't it?
It certainly is. And I think it is not surprising that people are sidling away and discovering, you know, urgent appointments at home. And you know, who would want this job? You've got to try to make appear reasonable a man who is given to impulsive behaviour and tweeting at 5 in the morning. And the hapless Sean Spicer is, you know, left to try to put a decent gloss on this. He's volatile. He's been shouting and, you know, throwing the furniture around. And I don't think that's going to change. I think people know what they're looking at. But even before this problem with his inner circle, his administration had an amazing number of seats, 85% of the jobs that should have been filled in the first 6 months have not even got a nominee. So these are nominations that will have to go through Congress, so there's a whole lot of procedure. They haven't even got nominees for them. I mean, this has been the most incompetent transition in many a long year. So there are real questions about who's running the US administration at this point.
Robert, those lack of nominees, part of it is that, you know, the feeling that he never thought he was going to win in the first place. So he hadn't really kind of done all the groundwork. Now there's a feeling there's a lag because people don't want to join the administration. How much do you think it is making a difference to, you know, all of the key pillars of state that he just doesn't have enough people in place and he can't seemingly attract always the best talent?
I think it is a huge problem because, as Isabel says, there's a whole swathe, there are whole areas, I gather, of the White House that are just not peopled. He is leaving far too much to too few people, and we've had Sean Spicer, as you mentioned, but his boss or co-mart or whatever seems to be leaving. He seems to ask, whenever something really nasty comes up about Russia, he seems to ask yet again H.R. McMaster to front up in front of the cameras and the microphones. It is really quite bizarre. I think there is a problem with the way the man sees his own communication skills. He thinks he's the great communicator. He thinks he can out-communicate a Clinton or a Ronald Reagan or whoever. So we have this tyranny of the 140-character tweet. And I think that this is where we are really coming to a crunch now. There are two things, just two for instances this week, that are expected. One, I think I understand absolutely has to be done. Otherwise, it goes away for a year or more. And that is the move, long heralded in the election campaign, of the US embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, which is something that really cannot be done on an impulse, which I wonder if the man at the top, the commander-in-chief, really understands. But the other thing which could have colossal implications is the formal withdrawal from the Paris climate change accord. That seems more likely to happen, but it is being done in the most casual, unstaffed way, which is rightly causing comment or among the bad people like us and the mainstream and the mainstream media. I think he himself is having a great deal of difficulty. I don't think he's even got to second base in seeing there is a real crisis, as we were saying in our previous discussion about Afghanistan, about the limitations of the US reach. The interesting thing that Mrs. Merkel alluded to this time, and I think they're beginning to get it, that America really doesn't actually have that capacity to engage with Europe and Europe's problems in the way that it could do even 3 or 4 years ago, take 2011 and Libya. So you've got two things. I agree. And there is a general perception of this. The man is flailing himself, personally. But the issues, the problems, they are piling up and they can't all be shoveled in the middle into the too difficult box.
I think Jared Kushner's going to solve them all, isn't he?
Well, you see, now he is in... The bad people
the
are really
in
getting into him, yeah.
I was going to say, we should talk about him for a moment because he is interesting because he is the filter through which Donald Trump feels comfortable dealing with a lot of the administration and all sorts of powers and responsibilities being given to him. Now, if he gets absolutely tied up with this Russia inquiry... I read a really couple of great pieces the last few days by a commentator saying, look, he's going to be awake at night worrying about what he's going to do the next day. He's not going to have time to do all the things that Donald Trump wants. And it may become to the point where he just has to step aside for the time it's going to absorb dealing with all these questions. Then what happens when Donald Trump has to deal with lots of people who he doesn't quite trust? And then you have a more isolated president. And that's more dangerous, isn't it, Isabel?
Well, I suppose it is. But I mean, Jared Kushner's in-tray was looking completely ridiculous anyway. He was supposed to be in charge of solving the Middle East, reorganizing the entire federal government. I forget, it's a long list. And I think that actually what we're looking at is an administration that can't make any decisions. Trump has put off the decision on Paris. Mm. Repeatedly, it was meant to be today again. And, the latest rumour that I was looking at was that it was going to be postponed yet again. People have prepared all their statements for every eventuality. But it is also another characteristic of Trump that he appears to, be impressed by the last person who sits on him, and that, there's a battle going on for his ear over this with between the leavers and the remainers. And the remainers are pretty extraordinary. Every major corporation in the United States, including the oil companies, are saying remain, stay in the Paris Agreement. Mm. Steve Bannon and the people he's put in charge of domestic environmental policy are committed climate deniers and saying leave. He appears incapable of choosing between them.
But that's his constituency, though, isn't it? The Bannon, the talk show, the Rush Limbaughs, and so on.
Urging him to, as it were, keep his pledge to the voters. But and yes, that's true. And I think you're right about the problem if Jared Kushner goes, because there is, he appears to be a paranoid character, Trump, I mean. So without that family bond, I think we are going to look at even more chaos.
Well, you're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Tuck, Robert Fox and Isabel Hilton, and I promise no chaos when we come back.
Who can say where the world's headed? Well, with Monocle's transport-themed June issue in tow, you'll reach your destination enlivened and entertained, and with a good read on where things are heading. We stop off in Van, a Turkish city with a Persian pull that's luring fun-loving Iranians across the border. We meet Munich's fast-moving mobility players, getting gear with the finest bike retailers, and work up a sweat at Techno Gym's Toothsome HQ in Emilia Romagna in Italy. We're also on set in New York, in Hamburg for the annual Aircraft Interiors Expo, and in Albania for the Prime Minister's fictional final feast. All that, plus Oslo's fashion startups, the small-scale supermarkets with big ideas, and a peek at London's most ambitious new hospitality venture. So strap in. Monocle's high-octane transport issue is on newsstands now. Or head to monocle.com to become a subscriber.
Well, welcome back to Midori House, live from London. I'm Andrew Tuck, and still with me are Robert Fox and Isabel Hilton. Now, ever since Jeremy Corbyn became the leader of Britain's Labour opposition, his perceived inability to appeal to the nation's mainstream has seen him almost typecast as unelectable. But a new poll out today suggests that the political tides are changing, raising the extraordinary prospect of a hung parliament. Robert, before we came on air, we were gossiping about this. I think we all agreed it's just a bizarre election. It's very hard to read what's going on. The polls are all over the place. The leaders don't seem to be living up to the scripts we've written for them. What do you make of where we're at?
I think we're reaping the whirlwind of last year, the great post-truth year, that the fact is that we had things like Brexit, which is very much the thing behind this election. It's why Mrs. May went to the country, supposedly, to get a stronger majority, give her 5 years so she could see the thing through. I think the wheels are coming off all these pledges because somehow, to use a military expression, the centre of gravity of the battle, where it's really being fought, is not what they expected it to be. It's about all kinds of things. Because regarding Brexit, I think, which is a very important factor, one is, despite a lot of megaphone campaigning, there is no easy solution to migration, which was behind a lot of the thinking. Equally, there is going to be no clean break, and you are going to be poorer. And there's a general feeling of frustration and limbo and gloom and a terrible mistake, I think tactical mistake, in the way that the Prime Minister has fought her campaign. Staying out of the limelight, stumping the country or going around the country as if she was Queen Elizabeth I on a progress to her provinces, which seems to be, and also sort of treating constituents rather like Queen Elizabeth I, the great Queen Gloriana, would have treated her subjects. No back chat, please. You know, she really has not campaigned at all well. And just to pick up your point, the thing about Jeremy Corbyn, I think he has surprised people in that how comfortable he is with himself. So he does talk to people. He does have, as was shown, this is why they didn't kick him out as leader of the Labour Party. He has a very strong youth support and a youth vote. And that is why he's not doing nearly as badly as expected. I don't expect him to be Prime Minister, but if I expect Mrs. May to be returned, him to be an absolutely broken back Prime Minister.
Yeah, digging into some of the numbers today, it's the youth vote is with him. For the first time, the very kind of labouring class, as it were, are backing him for the first time. Women seem to like him a lot more than the electorate's made. I wonder, Isabel, one of her mistakes is, you know, she's made this, you know, the Brexit election. But actually, on both sides, you know, even the people who are Remainers, they've kind of given up in a way. Everyone's kind of, okay, we're going to leave. And in fact, that isn't the heart of the debate anymore. It's about social policy. It's about your hospitals, and it's about how you're going to be looked after when you're sick and old. Those are the things that are touch points more than Brexit. So while she bangs on about Brexit, Jeremy Corbyn has managed to kind of slip into a gap and start talking about all these things that actually people are thinking about.
And who'd have thought it? But I think that what we're seeing is all the things that people were angry about, which perhaps contributed to that Brexit vote. You know, when they get a chance to kick the dog, they kick the wrong dog. But people were undoubtedly angry, and they're still angry that they're paying for a financial crisis when the people who caused it, the bankers, are still drawing enormous salaries and not suffering. They're looking at, you know, the wreckage of the social safety net. These things matter to people. They're looking at their children who can't afford to buy houses, and many of them don't have the prospect of a stable job. So there is a lot of rage, and I think it's extraordinary. But nevertheless, Jeremy Corbyn has managed, as you say, to tap into that, because he's talking about the condition of Britain What we're getting from Theresa May is a kind of fantasy nostalgia Britain, a promise of the better yesterday that we're all supposed to sign up to, and it's just not resonating with people.
And it's interesting, just the day before the last day you could vote to register, some 250,000 young voters registered. I mean, the feeling is they are for Corbyn. He seems to be reaching a constituency which is, oddly, a bit of a Trumpian constituency, people who don't normally vote. So a lot of people who felt that actually all the parties kind of say exactly the same thing. At least they're now being faced with some differences, and he seems to articulate that.
They are being faced with some differences, but perhaps not, the key difference would be if one major party was pro-Brexit and the other was not. And I think that would really offer a choice which at the moment is not being offered in this country. But if you look at those young people, and certainly young people not turning out to vote has meant that they haven't been catered for in policy terms for a very long time. But they voted, those that voted 70% to remain in the European Union. And they have seen their kind of welfare landscape chipped away, with ever-increasing student fees, with poorer job prospects, in favour of the people who do vote, who are the older cohort in the electorate, who have had their pensions protected and so on. And I think those young people have finally woken up. Perhaps the shock of Brexit, which they didn't want, has made them understand that actually it does matter both to register and to get out and vote.
Yeah, it's a slight revenge of the people who got, young voters felt that they were ignored during that Brexit campaign. Now, before we kind of end the show today, let's hear a little bit of the number one single on the iTunes chart here in the UK this week.
We have a mission to make Britain a country that works, not for the privileged and not for the few, but for every one of our citizens. And together, we, the Conservative Party, can build a better Britain.
Well, that's Liar, Liar by Captain Scar, which, as you might have guessed, lampoons British Prime Minister Theresa May. Since its release on Friday, it's climbed to the top of the charts. But aside from the satirical aspect, the success of the song also raises some questions about the state of generational politics in the UK. When the EU referendum was held last year, 75% of people aged between 18 and 24 voted to remain, a demographic who, at least for now, doesn't seem to have had a voice in Westminster at all. So this is carrying on with the theme that we've already had here, Robert. How important do you think that is? When we look at the way that the vote's going to go, again, looking at those numbers today, if you look at who the people 65 plus, it's something like 70% of them are going to vote Tory. And the younger voters are divided in the opposite direction. Is that always the case, do you think, that you grow up wild and socialist and then you end up being a diehard Tory?
That's always the cliche, isn't it? I'm not sure, because I think some extraordinary things are happening. Mrs. May has alienated, which we should have said in a previous discussion, the poorer middle class, because there's this tag of the dementia tax of having to sell your house and pay for it until you're down to your last 100,000. It has resonated through the Conservative press, which is so interesting. It looks a colossal blunder. The other thing which is becoming clear, we're being very metropolitan London centric. And by the way, I think that's a problem with Theresa May, as somebody put it to me in Whitehall just the other day, saying we're getting exclusively the view from Maidenhead, which is almost a suburb of London. It's very, 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 very sudden. Is Scotland. The most successful Conservative campaigner is Ruth Davidson. Ruth Davidson has no compunction saying privately to all those who will listen, one of her greatest difficulties in fighting a serious Conservative Party campaign in Scotland is getting over the Theresa May factor. So, wow, watch this. And a Conservative supporter, Died in the Wool, was on the radio the other day, and I was quite astonished to hear him say that actually, for my money, in her public persona, whatever she is privately, she's coming over as really rather an unattractive person, because she won't answer the questions. She's got the dementia tax. She's not engaging in television debates, conspicuously so, with only one or two exceptions.
And this strong and stable business is coming over as overbearing, which people don't like.
Yeah, strong and stable seems to have been dropped from the lexicon, though. I wonder if they realise that isn't quite hitting home anymore. Well,
Robert Fox and Isabel Hilton, thank you so much for joining us on Midori House. The show was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Guy Lutz, and also by Hunter Charlton. And our studio manager was Toby Hammond. There's more music next. Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow. For me, Andrew Tuck, thank you and goodbye.